This is Writer's Cast, a podcast about books and authors. I'm your host, David Wilk. And today I'm talking to Jessica Anya Blau about her book, her newest book, The Trouble with Lexi, which is a novel. And we talked, this is 2017. We talked 3 years ago about one of your earlier books, The Wonder Bread Summer.
Right. Yeah.
Which was a really fun
book.
It's
great to be back. Thank you for having me back. Well, I love your show.
Well, thank you. And I like this book a lot. I was, as with many, with some novels, most novels we talk about, I don't ever want to give away the ending. I don't want to ruin anything for anybody. So I'll just say that the book's ending is a huge surprise. And very exciting, and I think it will reward readers to get there, because I think you kind of are lulled into not realizing what's going to happen, which is great.
Oh, well, I'm glad to hear that was your experience. That's great. Yeah, I definitely didn't want to give anything away too soon, but I also wanted, when the reader got there, I wanted you to believe that that's what happened, so that when you got there, then suddenly you rewind in your head and it all makes sense.
Right. And that I felt that way. I think that is important, that you don't want a surprise ending to simply be a surprise. It has to be consistent with the character and with the story. And I think in this case that worked.
Good.
You know, I do. I mean, I think, again, in hindsight, I wouldn't want to ruin this for anybody, but you do realize as you're reading along that Lexi, your main character, is making some significantly bad mistakes in her choices. And you keep wanting to say, don't do that.
Yeah, you do. You want to shout at her. I mean, hopefully the way we want to shout at our friends sometimes. I mean, I definitely want people to like her or to love her, because I certainly do. And, you know, I wanted her to be somebody we can love and like, who we see making these massive mistakes. And that doesn't make us think she's terrible, just that terrible things are going down.
Right. No, you don't dislike her. I mean, she's not an irritating. Right. There are some people who make bad decisions. You get irritated with them after a while.
Right.
You just want to, not just shout at them, you want to shake them and say, just don't be that way. But
right.
I didn't feel that she was a caricature in that way. But she's very, I mean, she's a really full-fledged person, as are her friends and a lot of the people in the story. I think you have a lot of really well-formed characters.
Thank you.
But I had to wonder, you know, how does she sort of psychically, what do you make of her, you know, in your own life? It's like, is she a projection of a part of you that you would, you know, that you feel like you're happy you are not?
I feel very connected to her. I have made huge mistakes in my life. I mean, so many huge mistakes and embarrassments and wrong turns. And I feel like I'm still making them. And maybe as I get older, I'm making fewer and fewer. And hopefully the consequences aren't as big. But the things she does, I haven't done, especially what happens in the end, the big, terrible thing that happens. But I do feel that under the right circumstances, at a certain point in my life, things could have winnowed down, you know, with bad decision, bad decision, bad decision, that I could have ended up in that place. So she is sort of my worst case scenario projection of myself in a different time. You know, because, I mean, I do think that in a way we're all capable of these things, especially when you fall in love and your brain is flooded with all these hormones and chemicals and you can't make a rational decision and you're not seeing things clearly. I mean, I read somewhere that you should never make an important decision within the first 2 years of falling in love, because your judgment is exactly as good as it would be if you were on crack. And so just that idea, you know, and projecting that idea onto Lexi kind of created a whole story, and also was, you know, allowed me to look at myself and the things that I had done when I first fell in love with different people. So she is a worst case scenario of the way, you know, I mean, she's a totally different profession. She, of course, she's thinner, blonder, and, you know, and she has a totally different childhood than I, but she's neurotic and superstitious and suffers from panic attacks and carries Klonopin with her. And I am all of those things. So I get where she's at, and, you know, and so I felt really sympathetic for her. I mean, I felt like we could all be there. I mean, maybe I project too much onto other people, because I always think that everything I'm capable of, or everything I think everybody else thinks and is capable of, but I could be entirely wrong about that.
Well, it doesn't necessarily have to be everyone. You know, a cautionary tale does not need to caution. It doesn't mean that each of us says to ourselves, that could be me, in a literal sense.
Right.
But it can be, we can look at that and learn from a cautionary tale.
Right.
You know, by applying it indirectly back onto our own wrong choices, let's say. They don't have to be the same wrong choices she makes. We don't even have to suffer from the same foibles that she does. And of course, you know, that's the beauty of fiction, is that you can make all of this up. So it doesn't have to necessarily literally reflect someone's life.
Right. And we can live it without living it. We can live it internally and emotionally. Right. Yes, no, you're right. I mean, I wouldn't expect that you would make the same choices after falling in love that I might make. But just in that people are vulnerable, and your heart makes you vulnerable, you know. And then the other things, like anxiety and worrying. And are there people who have zero anxiety and don't worry? I mean, maybe there are, but I don't know if I've met them. And if there are, I want to be those people. I want to find out how somebody can live in this world and not worry about anything and have zero anxiety. Like, I would love to be that person, or to know that person. I mean, so in those ways, you know, so I think certain things feel universal to me, but they actually really might not. Maybe like everybody in Nebraska has no anxiety and neuroses, and I just have never been to Nebraska.
Well, I don't know whether you want to pick on Nebraska, but
well, I'm giving Nebraska credit. That would be like a great place. I'm praising Nebraska for their lack of anxiety and neuroses.
No, I guess I was thinking that I was sort of looking at it in the other way, and that is, there must be something wrong with you if you don't have any anxieties.
So you sort of agree with me then that we're all, you know, somewhat, everything's a little tweaky inside everybody.
Well, or else if you're not fully engaged in living, then you could live your life without worrying, I suppose. It's sort of like Alfred E. Newman is the character that we think of as like, what, me worrying?
Right.
I mean, so if you're not, you know, unconscious, then you have to, you know, it's pretty hard to be without worry. But of course, but anxiety and you know, I think there is some element of, you know, urban, suburban, modern, complicated life that makes people more anxious and more disrupted. So there are probably places where, yes, people have anxiety, but the lifestyle and the nature of the environment that they live in is not quite so conducive to maybe damaging hyper anxiety and, you know, the kind of out of balance anxiety that people have sometimes. And maybe you, even Lexi, your character, has a bit of, because you have to feel like anyone who would take Klonopin in order to be able to survive daily life does have a bit of an unresolved problem.
Yes. Right. And she's trying not to take the Klonopin, but she, yeah, things get a little off balance there. Yes.
Yeah.
And yeah, no, I mean, I agree. And I would love to never take a Klonopin, but, that's not, I take it every time I do a reading. That's where my anxiety peaks.
Interesting. Yeah. Well, I can, yeah, I can understand that. Well, I've never taken any of those things, so I don't even know what it feels like. But I know, of course, that a lot of people do. So, does it kind of take the edge off? Is that what it's for?
Oh, yeah. I mean, so I don't know if I've somehow managed to keep it so that I can only take a Klonopin when I'm doing a public reading, but somehow that's my most, you know, public speaking, public reading. And I take one and it makes me completely normal because my anxiety level is so high that it just brings me to this normal place so that nobody can tell I've taken anything because I just seem like a normal person. But I've never done a reading. Every time I've done a reading with other people, which is frequently because one way to manage my anxiety is to always ask other writers to read with me when I can. So, and I've never done a reading with someone who didn't take something. I don't drink, if not alcohol. Like I've never done a reading with a writer who did it completely sober without people take Klonopin and they take, some heart thing. I forget what it's called. Hmm. You know, some heart medication that they just like calms them down, like slows their heart rate and calms them down. So it's always sort of funny, and I will pull the people I'm reading with, like, what are you taking? What are you on? What are you on? Because I'm just to sort of keep it real. Like, okay, I just took my Klonopin. What did you take? And so that's why maybe because I'm hanging out with too many writers and we're all insane, maybe that's where I think everybody is neurotic and crazy. But yeah, that is where my... that's where my Klonopin works for me. So every time, you know, before I go on book tour or have a bunch of things to do, I'll go see my doctor and she knows and she gives me a prescription for 30 and that, you know, that will do it for me. It's, but I would love to be somebody who didn't have to do that. I would love to be the person who just felt completely at ease at all times, but I'm not. And Lexi is not. And you know, I mean, I was trying to complicate her life in the book so that it was so many things coming together, the anxiety and panic disorder, the falling in love, the coming from poverty and this really terrible home life and being thrown into the private boarding school world that has just incredible privilege and wealth and sort of throw her into all of these situations that would kind of keep cornering her into these bad decisions that would create drama.
Right. Well, no, I think that definitely you felt all those, the drama. I mean, we as the reader feel that. I wanted to ask you about the boarding school environment. And I guess we should say that, you know, Lexi is like a counselor in this, fairly well-to-do boarding school, I think outside of Boston. Did you go to a boarding school or how'd you kind of figure that out?
Well, my ex-husband went to Exeter and he had all these great, you know, boarding school stories and they were completely fascinating to me. Just because the life in the boarding school is extreme. I mean, there's an intimacy with your teachers that you don't normally have in regular school. There's an intimacy with the people you live with that you don't have. And then there's the freedom of being away from your parents. I mean, it sort of heightens everything. But I think one of the most interesting things is the intimacy with the teachers and that relationship of actually living with your teachers so that they sort of are crossing the line between teachers and parents. And it's, you know, it's a strange boundary, you know, that changes just by the fact that, you know, and that there's teachers who live within each dorm. So it was an interesting setup. And I thought it would be interesting to explore, you know, the most prestigious boarding school with somebody who came from nothing, you know, and to just be thrown into this place where people give $1 million donations and that kind of stuff. Like the setting just seemed rich to me, you know, and I liked sort of the containment of it.
Well, yeah. And it is, I agree that it does give you that a set of tensions, and also it gives you that kind of, atmosphere of, interesting dynamic play between all the different teachers, you know, the politics of and the relationships of all the different teachers to each other and the,
right.
to the parents and to the kids. And I thought that was, that was pretty interesting.
I mean, well, that's like, I mean, when I moved to Baltimore with two little kids and we live in the city proper where you, at the time when we moved here, you couldn't go to the public school. You know, there's like armed policemen there and there was no library, there's no funding and it was just, you know, and so I had to put my kids in a private school and I'm not from that world. I'm from Southern California where we, you know, roller skated to school and went to the beach after school and it was all very mellow and, you know, we studied the tide pools. And so suddenly I had to put my girls in this and I put them in a private girls school. It was a day school. And it was just this world that I knew nothing about. And it was so bizarre to me, like the kids who were there, whose mothers went there and whose grandmothers went there and whose great grandmothers went there. And the head of the school had gone there and her daughters went there. And the head of the lower school went there. And it was this weird, it was just a very bizarre world to me. And I always felt like this weirdo outsider. You know, I would show up at school functions and I'd be wearing jeans and I'd look around and I'd realize I was the only mother in jeans. And I thought, are we not allowed to wear jeans? We're watching like a bunch of third graders sing a song in French. Like, why can't we wear jeans? Like, it was all so foreign to me. So a lot of it also is sort of taking my sort of having landed in that world in Baltimore where people are used to this. This is how it goes in Baltimore. And then my husband's stories of Exeter, ex-husband's stories, and just sort of, you know, throwing this world that was interesting to me and not entirely appealing. I mean, it was interesting to me, but I think there's so many huge flaws in it, with privilege and insiderness and, you know, the exclusivity of it and writing, you know, having a story take place in it. So it was fun though. I mean, I enjoyed getting in there. But this is the other thing is I'm such a neurotic, crazy parent that I am, because I was completely neglected as a child. So I overcompensated for that with my own children. But I used to sub at the school every now and then just to sort of spy on the school and spy on my kids. And I'd sit in the lunchroom and I was always shocked. Or I'd sit in the faculty lounge and they wouldn't, you know, because there's a lower school, middle school, upper school. And when my kids were in lower school, nobody in the middle school or upper school knew who I was. I just thought I was another sub. But I would be sitting in there sort of spying on them, listening to the teachers talk in the teacher's lounge about the students and about classes and about parents and about different things. And I was just, it was always so shocking to me, the things they would say. So I carried that with me when I was working on the relationships between the teachers and how the teachers themselves related to the school and how some of them were lifers and that they, you know, they would leave all their possessions when they died to the school and, you know, that kind of thing. So I sort of ripped that out of my experience here in Baltimore.
Yeah, no, I felt that. And I thought that was interesting. The, you know, the kind of community of teachers with a different view of the world, you know, than the families that they were necessarily in contact with. Not all of them. And as you say, the lifers, you know, who kind of, kind of come from and believe in that world versus,
right.
you know, the reality of the other, a lot of the other teachers
right.
completely different.
Right.
No, that was I liked that part of it. And, you know, I think also the, relationships that, or the contact Lexi has with life, you know, outside of the school where she's like a real person, not kept away from, you know, going out for a drink and, you know, having a real complicated life
right.
story. You know, I think that was kind of contrasted nicely to the Ivory Tower like environment of the school.
Right. Yeah. And it's also, it's a weird power structure in those schools. I mean, you have the people who work there who are being paid sometimes and maybe most often less than the year's tuition. And so, you know, they're living on far less than the families of these children. And the children, if they wanted to get these people fired, do have the power to call their parents if they're big donors or they're, you know, alumni, and to sort of undo these teachers' lives. And yet the teachers are supposed to be in charge of the kids. I mean, it's this weird power dynamic where money does come into play. Money and influence and family and how much your family donated to the school that year. And so just the whole, all the power plays are interesting to me, which doesn't exist in a public school. You're a teacher, you have students, the teachers are in charge of the students. Yeah, I mean, of course, somebody could, you know, throw a fit about something and get somebody fired, but it's not the same sort of structure.
No, that's
as
true.
These institutions.
That is true.
Yeah. So it was definitely a fun setting for me to write about. You know, I was like having fun coming up with these teachers and, you know, and the faculty who hate the students, because of course every school has a couple of faculty who just loathe the students. We know that being students ourselves, we all had the teacher who we could tell hated being there, you know, and hated teaching at some point. So it was, you know, so these people were fun to write. It was fun to dig into that.
And
dig into Lexi's life.
So when you have been out in public reading from this book or talking about it, what's the theme of conversation that you have with readers? You know, what kind of things do people talk about the most?
When I've been reading, the opening. And so people are always, you know, I don't know if I should say the opening or not, but, you know, I mean, the opening is when Lexi wakes up in the bed of somebody, you know, finds herself there, and it's the parent of a kid from the school, and she's gone to these parents' house and wakes up, and, you know, she's suddenly discovered there, like Goldilocks and the Three Bears. So people are, you know, people ask questions about, I mean, I always read the opening, and to which people are like, well, what happens or where's it go? But I don't quite get to the private school bit. I mean, mostly the question I'm asked is, how did you come up with the idea for this book? And the way I came up from the idea from this book is I was giving a talk at an event in DC where they had this lots of security. And before the event, the security came up and they said, I think you have a stalker. I said, you think I have a stalker? And he said, there's somebody who's come out of prison and from like two states away, I don't know where, and has driven here and paid money to come to this event to see you, and we're worried about it. And I said, okay, well, you know, but there's security there. I was like, okay, I'm not worried about it. You know, and they said, don't worry about it. You don't have to speak to him, and we're on it. I was like, okay, I'm not going to worry about it. And then at some point in the event, you know, somebody showed me a picture and they said, that's him. That's the guy who came out of prison. And I look over and here's this great looking guy who kind of looks like a movie star in a really nice suit. And I thought, you just came out of prison and you're my stalker. And of course I was sort of surprised I have a stalker. I thought, I've never had a stalker. Nobody's going to stalk me. So of course I'm incredibly curious about this guy. And I made a beeline across the room and started talking to him, was just trying to lead the conversation so that he would tell me where he's been the last few years, since I didn't want to come out and ask him why he was in prison. And eventually he said he's been in prison. And I said, oh, well, what were you in prison for? And he said, well, I was a drug addict and I stole some drugs. And I said, you know, I'm sorry. I mean, I feel bad for drug addicts. I don't necessarily think they should be in prison. And I said, oh, I'm sorry. That sounds terrible. And then he said, well, the problem wasn't so much that I stole the drugs. The problem was that I fell asleep on the bed of the owner of the drugs and they came home and found me. And when he said that, I thought, oh, that would be a good opening to a book. So I just, that image stuck in my head of coming home and finding someone passed out asleep in your bed who had taken your prescription Klonopin. You know, I mean, I have a prescription for it in my medicine cabinet. That could happen to me. And just the idea of just coming home, you know, not somebody who wants to kill you or harm you or even steal your stuff, just somebody who wanted to take your Klonopin. You know, it just seems like such a nonviolent crime. I just wanted your Klonopin. So that image of this person asleep in the bed with the prescription pill bottle, it just, I couldn't get it out of my head. And so when I came up with, you know, this was a guy, but when I came up with Lexi, I just thought, oh, it would just seem like a great opening image to me. And so that's where the book starts, with Lexi in that position.
Right.
And then, of course, the story goes back in time.
Right. So, yeah, it's a flashback from there. Well, just out of curiosity, how long was it from the time that you had this experience of talking to the stalker and getting the image of him lying in a bed, between that and when you actually came up with the book? Did it sort of percolate, or was this, you know, you held on to it for a while, or did it immediately set you out to, oh, I got to write this book?
What I did is I immediately, and by the way, he wasn't a stalker. He was a guy who in prison started writing and had read my books and was interested in writing and wanted to hear a writer speak. He was like, he was a writer. He was like me and you. So, who happened to have been in jail for stealing drugs. But I think after that moment that was stuck in my head, I wrote a short story where this happened. And the short story sort of focused on this moment. And I was like, well, who is, and I changed it to a woman because there's something more interesting to me about a woman actually breaking into a house and stealing drugs. It's just more jarring and it's less threatening, you know, this young woman in your bed. It's much less threatening.
More likely to lead to humor too.
I guess so. Right. Yeah. And it's not, you're not going to like, you know, pick up a knife and hold it over, you know, this person in your bed if it's just this, you know, youngish woman there. So, I wrote a short story, and I think at the time it was called The Problem with Lexi. And I wrote this short story, and it sort of just, and she was, did work at a private boarding school. I was trying to think, who is she and what is she doing and how did she get here? And the story was published, you know, and I got paid for it and it was published and all that. And then when I had this short story, I thought, oh, this would make I was starting a new book, and my editor at HarperCollins, Kate Nitzel, who's incredibly smart and talented, I was starting like three different books at once. And I sent her to the start to all three of the books I was starting. And one of them was the short story I'd written. And then there was two other novel starts. And I said, which one would you be most interested in reading? And she said, Lexi. So then I sat down and wrote the book. So it did start, I think I did write the short story right away. And then, you know, and that took a while. And then, but in writing the short story, I created, she became clear to me and the world became clear to me. And I knew who Lexi was and I knew what her world was. And I just went from there and created the book. But it's a more of a running start when you already know who you're dealing with and what their world is. So I did feel a sort of push when I started, and I didn't know where it would end. I had no idea where it would end, and that it would end where it does, the ending of which we have not spoken, right, or we haven't revealed the ending. So the I didn't know it was going to go. This is a secret explosive ending. I didn't know it would have that ending, and I wrote many, many different endings, but that was the ending that stuck. Or that, I mean, I knew I was leading to parts of that, but yeah. But that was, it was fun to write towards that. It was fun to try and figure out how to get her into this really terrible place.
Well, yeah. And
it's always more fun writing about people in trouble than to write about somebody where everything is going well and everything's great is boring. You know, it's like the phone calls with your friend where her life is great and everything's great and she's in love and everything's perfect. I mean, as soon as she starts talking, you start emptying the dishwasher. But the friend who's in trouble, where everything's falling apart and her boyfriend's lying or somebody's cheating or somebody's stealing for what, that person is, that's when you stop emptying the dishwasher. You stop emptying the dishwasher for the drama and you start emptying it for the good stuff. So for me, it's the same with writing. I'd much rather write about things going wrong than things going right.
Well, and it's just making me think about that some people in our lives, I'm sure we all have run across them, who have that, they create drama in their own lives, perhaps for the right. same reason. You know, maybe that's, I hadn't thought of it quite that way, but it's that, you know, it gives them something to pay it, you know, it makes it more interesting for them that boring life is right. is not what they want. They want to have something really complicated that makes their lives miserable that they, so they can, right. you know, they have something to pay attention to.
Right. And to grab their friend's attention, so, you know, look at me. You
yeah.
know? I mean, I think I'm at this point, I'm a fairly, you know, I don't drink, I don't do drugs other than Klonopin when I'm reading, as we said, you know, I don't smoke. I mean, I think that my life is fairly low drama. So in my writing world, it's, there's a lot of high stakes. I mean, it's all coming out there.
Well, that's so a lot safer.
It's more fun for
right.
me.
Right. It's a lot safer, too.
It's way safer. And I'm too high anxiety at this point to do anything risky other than write something risky. You know,
well, so
I couldn't handle it emotionally.
I noticed, I think it was on your website, that you're giving a talk next week. Well, this is now, we're April, so I'm kind of pinning us to April 2017, but at the City Lit Festival in Baltimore on sex in books. So you are taking a risk there.
I guess it's with a woman who's a prostitute who wrote a memoir. It's the two of us, and I, you know, so I'm actually, I have a few events coming up, and I'm not straight on what's what. Tomorrow I'm at the Bethesda Literary Festival on women fiction or something. You know, I don't know how these titles come up for these things, but I'm happy anybody will have me anywhere, and I'm happy to show up.
So do you have a book in the works that you want to talk about, or anything coming up that you're working on?
Well, I'm working on three books, but it's sort of like saying I'm working on three pregnancies. So I'm right now readings and all that stuff, it's all about the trouble with Lexi. Cause the other stuff is all in the works, and it'll change 20 times before I finish it.
Do you ever feel like though testing stuff that you're working on, not just with your editor, but maybe with an audience where you can read stuff and, you know, kind of get a feel for it, not necessarily by the response that you get, but by how it feels to you when you read it to people?
Yeah. You know, I don't do that. I do see people do that often. I mean, I've gone to so many readings where writers will say, this is something new that I'm working on, and they're reading, you know, manuscript pages fresh out of their computer. And I think that takes a certain amount of sort of courage and self-confidence that I don't have. I mean, it's almost like if it's been published, then I know there's at least three people who think it's good enough to go out in the world, you know, the publisher, the editor, the publicist or something, you know, and then I can sort of stand there and read it and feel like, you know, this is okay. But until that point, I think because I write so much. I mean, my writing way is more like vomiting up volumes of stuff and then picking through it to find the best. That I don't know if anything that's in the works and that I haven't fully decided on is ever worth hearing. Just because I revise so much, you know, that it's really, it's more the creating process, creating something is, I mean, I wouldn't say easy, but it's like it all comes out of me. And then the real work is in revising it just over and over and over and over again.
Yeah,
I mean, the trouble with Lexi, I looked on my computer and I had 20 full start to finish revisions of the entire novel. So it's a lot of rewriting for me.
Yeah, that's amazing. I think that is something that people underestimate often, is how much work goes into the rewriting and revising, and that books represent just a tremendous amount of work.
Yeah, it's true. I mean, I'm teaching right now, and students, I mean, I have these really smart, great, talented students, and they pop something out, and it's great. And it's like, okay, that's great. Now go revise it 20 times. And yeah. And they don't get that, because you don't, there are few other things in life, if you're great at it, that what you do just isn't good enough until you've done it 20 more times. You know, I mean, math, you do it, it's done, it's right. And chemistry, you do it, it's done, it's right. But writing, you do it, it's done, it's always just a good start, and it's never right.
Yeah.
Unless you're Stephen King or something.
But. Well, I think even, I have rarely run across writers who are capable of doing great work without it having gone through revisions, many, many revisions, lots of just, you know, reconstitutions sometimes, you know, a book.
Yeah.
And also the thing that I think that also a lot of people are not aware of is how many books are written and put in a drawer. You know, you write an entire book and it's not good enough and it can't be revised, so you just put it away.
Yeah. No, it's true. I mean, first of all, I think Stephen King said in an interview that he doesn't revise, but he's the only person I've ever heard say that. So that's why I mentioned him. But everybody else I know who's published, people, you know, I meet plenty of people who are talented and great and aren't published, but I feel like, you know, to get to that place, it's almost a commitment to having the novel in the drawer or novels in the drawer and having, you know, doing it over and over again, because you can't figure out, you can't learn how to write a novel without writing a novel. So you always have to write one to learn how to write one. And then you have to write the one that's worth reading.
Right.
So it's most people's first novel is their third or their fourth or, you know,
right.
Seventh.
Yeah.
Something
well,
like that.
I think it is an amazing thing. Well, I really appreciate your talking to me about this book and about your writing process, which I think is really interesting. And I hope this book, I hope a lot of people hear this and want to go read the book.
Oh, thank you so much. And thank you for reading it. And thank you for talking to me. And thank you for doing your podcast, which I always enjoy, because I love hearing all the great writers you have on there.
Well, thank you, Jessica.
And interesting people that you have on there. So thank you so much.
Well, thanks. Well, this has been Writer's Cast, a podcast about books and authors. I've been talking to Jessica Anya Blau about The Trouble with Lexi, which is a wonderful book. Thanks so much.